Hello, this is Brian Cam, and you are listening to Clear Story, and more specifically, you are listening to the final installment in the experiment that I was running last year on meaningful living. In that experiment, I invited you, the listeners, to reflect openly on how you have navigated the tension between making a living and finding a meaningful life. So how have you balanced what you felt you needed to do to maintain the necessities of life with what you feel is your calling or purpose or reason for being? And I absolutely loved the responses. And today I've got another four for you. And these came in last year, so my apologies specifically to Peter, Olga, Rainbow, and Kevin for taking some time on getting these out. I was very, very happy to receive your messages, and I just managed to not release them until now. How do you balance making a living with living a meaningful life?
Hi there, everyone. Thanks for the invitation to participate, Brian. My name's Peter. I'm Australian. I live in France and earn a living working for pharmaceutical companies in new drug development. For me, there is some tension between the time I spend earning a living and things I consider more meaningful. How do I ensure there's a balance? I regularly remind myself that I'll be dead soon. I find that a great motivator. I'm always on the lookout for people with balance and consider what I can learn from them. I try to understand when and where to compromise. I can't be a stockbroker on a trading room floor 80 hours a week and learn a new language every 6 months. Some people can, I can't. So in the past, I've worked part-time. I've taken long career breaks for 6 months and so on. Not good for career progression, perhaps, but they've been great help to me in finding that balance between earning a living and more meaningful stuff. Finding efficiencies. I'm quite an organized person, and I've found that lots of full-time jobs can be done in 20 to 30 hours a week, particularly, once again, if you're not terribly ambitious in a professional sense. And that's been helpful for me to understand, find, and leverage. But for me, perhaps most importantly, is in seeking this balance, is knowing myself, understanding what is meaningful to me and why. You know, I think it's easy to thoughtlessly fetishize writing a novel or composing a symphony or something like that. Rather, I think it's important to be open-minded and creative about creativity. For me, it's always been important to mix it up. No one thing is likely to satisfy forever. I sometimes think about what I would regret not doing and find that a great way to sort of focus my mind on what is meaningful and how I'm going to achieve it. I think about my strengths and weaknesses. I try to be honest with myself about those. There are many meaningful things to do out there. And while I'm not sort of endorsing laziness or defeatism or mediocrity, I also have found it's really important not to set myself up to fail if I'm going to continue this journey towards meaningfulness. And just as a final thought, if it's not already obvious, I don't think this journey starts with figuring out how to strike a balance. I think the journey starts with figuring out what is meaningful to me and constantly revising that to suit whatever circumstances I can conjure up for myself. Thanks.
How do you balance making a living with living a meaningful life?
To better answer your question, I will describe how I became an artist. I was born with a hardwired curiosity for everything strange. This created a feedback loop. I wasn't able to engage with the outside world, so I did the one thing that made me happy, which was paying attention to strange things. I couldn't figure out my vocation for a really long time, and took whatever job seemed closest aligned with my interests. The thing is, social skills turned out to be important not just for life, but also for work, so a pattern developed. I'd spend a year in a new position, learn a bunch of things, and gradually, accidentally reveal to my coworkers that I was kind of weird. I continued collecting the strange things that I came across in my life, and this too fed a feedback loop where the focus of my attention changed the landscape of my mind. With every job, I got stranger and less suited for being a predictable part of a larger mechanism. In the last couple of years, my attraction to all things strange finally overcame my more sensible attributes. At work, I had really wonderful colleagues who treated me very well. But inevitably, conversation with me would turn kind of funky. I'd start talking about what we were doing, make observations about the tools we used. I asked questions about why people did what they did, talked about how our job affected us. I couldn't help it. They didn't want to do this with me, not because they couldn't or because they, not because they weren't interesting or smart enough. They just knew what was good for them, and this wasn't it. Whereas for me, this was a compulsion. It was like seeing the really big elephant and everybody refusing to talk about it. When the war began, the pressure of pretending like life was fine, like it was everything was continuing as usual, it became too much. My job began to give me physical ailments. I got heart palpitations, blurred vision, strange bodily sensations. Sometimes the ground beneath my feet would tilt and sway like I was at sea. And at this point, the choice wasn't between what I enjoyed or didn't enjoy. It was a choice between an uncertain future and a very certain present, where my job was sickening me. So I reasoned that if my job was guaranteed to ruin me anyway, then I would give in to my nature fully. I think that the artist's job is often one of chaos-based synthesis. You spend years developing taste using a kind of sorting mechanism. Your mind mutters to itself, "This is relevant, it goes into this bucket. That is not relevant, it can be ignored." And after enough iterations of this, it becomes a standard part of thinking, a kind of reflex. You develop a confidence in knowing that something is important, that you ought to pay attention to it. I feel that I have turned myself into an instrument that detects interesting and beautiful things. This is inherently a chaotic, unpredictable approach. You do not know when or how the reflex will be triggered, or what puzzle you're working on completing, or why. There is an infinite data set available to you at all times. You will never know which of the elements that you're able to perceive will grab you. So my feeling is that the matter of balance here is a relatively alien one. And this mechanism, the series of pumps and bellows, does not care what day of the week it is, or where you are. This has obvious drawbacks. It hurts me. It hurts others. It is very risky. But if I keep fighting myself to the point where I get sick, I'm not going to survive anyway. If I have to choose between dying from my job and suffering catastrophic failure from pursuing my nature, I know what I prefer, since I will die either way. In practical terms, until recently, I was on medical leave from work. And this leave has now come to an end. Last year, I won a small grant that will keep me afloat for a couple of months. And I am currently being considered for another bigger grant. So I'm leaning into my nature and attempting to be the most potent me that I can be. I don't really have any other plan. There is no choice. So if I fail, that is future me's problem.
How do you balance making a living with living a meaningful life?
Hi, Brian. Thank you for asking this question. It's a very rich one, and kind of, one of the most important ones, I think. How do we have a meaningful life? A life with meaning and survive, practically. I'm Bo and I'm living in London at the moment. And I feel like this has probably been, in some ways it's been a question that's been in the back of my mind and motivating my life decisions. With a more of a focus on, I've had a big emphasis in my life on meaning and doing what's felt like meaningful work. And less so on making a living, more in terms of just, I'm happy to get by with what I need. What I mean by that is I was following a career that was kind of in international development, working in charities, working in NGOs, where it felt, at least from my head, it felt meaningful. It felt like, at least my intention with it as well, was to make a difference and was to be a positive support initiatives that were making the world a better place in some way or another. So yes, there was some idealism there. And there was something there that also felt a little bit like kind of needing to, almost prove a point of like, yes, I'm doing meaningful work. And the day-to-day reality was that I didn't feel in touch with meaning, and I didn't feel in touch with vitality or my creative life. It was something I kind of pushed away quite a bit, kind of in my 20s, and kind of focused more on the serious nature of making the world a better place. But just kind of losing touch with my own self and my own creative life. Which all started to shift a few years ago when I went through some big life shifts and changes and challenges, which kind of threw lots of things on its head. As a result of that, my spiritual life kind of blossomed, and along with that, my creative life. And it felt like this shift from staying with, I was kind of forced to let go of what's known, and kind of more linear way of thinking and being in my head. And I just went through some experiences that just broke and also expanded my heart, and to delve into more of the unknown and the more kind of flowing, more of a flowing sense and energy, which for me is very connected to like being creative and being with that vastness and allowing things to unfold more organically. So while I have written, I kept a journal since I was a teenager, have stacks of books, journals, and I would kind of maybe do a little bit of making or being, making things, painting here and there. It was something that felt like a small cupboard that I kind of didn't open up very much. About a few years ago, when all these shifts were happening in me, just suddenly my creative life started to blossom too and became more urgent to put time and energy into. And that has just kept growing, even though there's this other part of me that's kind of pushed it away a little bit. And that for me is where I have found my meaning, is in allowing that life force to move through, yeah, it's kind of, I do feel like my creative life is connected to my vitality. And it's also quite scary because it is, yeah, I think of, it just feels like this watery, flowing, evolving space, spaciousness. And there are parts of me which prefer to stick to something more, yeah, more kind of more solid and more square-like. but this, yeah, my creative, my spiritual life, it feels like it has its own energy and its own momentum, and it just has kept growing. And I was still trying to find meaning through certain paths which felt acceptable, kind of approved by, and like my head would, felt validated by. So I was, after working in international development, I switched to more working in psychology, which I had was what I first studied. I'm working in children's mental health, which, yes, it also has its meaning and it has value. And still, day to day, I ended up feeling really stressed and stretched, and there was quite a fast pace to it, quite a shallowness to the work we were doing in some ways, and just not suitable to this more connecting to depths, connecting to, yeah, this creative force. And recently, I have moved towards a life which is more renunciation of, you know, on the money side of things, and wanting to simplify my life. And I've started working at a Buddhist centre and supporting the work there, which means it's a very different, in some ways it's not even work. It is, yeah. You know, I've been having conversations around letting go of the idea that I have a job anymore, and that I'm just supporting, you know, I'm working in a team with others, and we're supporting an initiative, and we are there to explore work as a spiritual practice. And for me, this feels really creative, because I think the most creative act is how we show up in the world, and how we are, and how we communicate, and how we evolve on the inside. So yeah, work as a spiritual practice, it means there's a lot of awareness. I'm surrounded by people who are very aware, meditate a lot, trying to live in an ethical way, and I have these very sharp, acute mirrors all around me, and a lot of light shining up where I am, my habits, the good and the bad, and my potential, my insecurities, and it's all there. And that feels very creative. And for me, that feels meaningful. I feel like there's transformation happening where it matters. And it's given me a lot of space to focus as well on my creative outlets. I'm working in an office where everyone is an artist, really. In some way or another. And this year I've started doing the artist's way with some friends, so learning to own that part of me, which is a poet, writes poems and paints, and approaching it as play, and yeah, approaching it as play. and for me, that's meaningful. I think it's more in line with the nature of life and reality, acknowledging that it is a play. It's playful, we're in a dance. And recognizing there's beauty everywhere, and just the ordinariness, or finding beauty in the ordinary, and also finding opportunities to create just in a small ongoing way, whether it's a doodle in a notebook or a poem on my phone, That for me feels meaningful because I think we're here to be alive. I think we're here to learn and to grow and to connect to our true nature. And yeah, meaningful life, making a living, maybe it's the same thing. I'm making life. I'm making myself become more alive, hopefully, and in the process I think that is how we all come alive. Inspired by others who are connecting to and living in a way that's integrity with what is meaningful for them. So, yeah, I mean, in monetary terms, I get by, I have my expenses covered and not more. And that's actually feels very freeing, because it allows me to focus on what is important. And the more I step away from what feels like a career and more into the moment, and more into just focusing on being rather than doing, this feels more meaningful. And it's a journey, and old parts of me are still a bit like, what are you doing? And it's also about having conditions and having a community and having people around you that are in similar paths, journeys, and trying to move towards being more alive and being connecting more to truth, whatever that is. I don't know. But the stretch and the journey towards it feels like that's what we should be doing and spending our time on. Yes, I managed to get to 12 minutes, so there we are. Thank you again, Brian. And thank you to everyone who has shared. I love hearing the responses. And there's something in what everyone has shared that has kind of touched me in some way. So thank you.
How do you balance making a living with living a meaningful life?
Hi there, my name is Kevin Bowers, and I'm responding to this question about living a meaningful life. In opposition to the idea of making a living. And you're not wrong when you say that is a worthy and complicated notion. And it is one that I have dealt with for sort of adult life. And so a few things come to mind. One is that I feel I've been very lucky in this regard. And I think luck is an ingredient but also sort of an intuitive sense that I have cultivated as a creative person that just sort of lent itself to making choices that have put me in a place where much of my making a living life has been satisfying to my making meaningful decision. So I'm a teacher. I'm a high school teacher. And I came to that a little bit late in not that late, but like I think 27 or 28, I started teaching. So I had, you know, those sort of liminal years there between university, say, and pissing about in the world as sort of like a musician and kind of a romantic and traveler. And, you know, so there were several years of sort of romping around, playing rock music and traveling. And there was always sort of a yearning in that, you know, towards the necessity of living a meaningful life and the recognition that it would be nice to make enough money to house myself properly and, you know, not every season return from North Africa to sleep on someone's couch in Peterborough. And sort of slowly the notion of teaching came to hold a lot of potential for living this rich, meaningful life. And I think my recognition of its of teaching being a vehicle for this kind of life was the vision of that was available to me because I had sort of practiced my creative consciousness sufficiently to recognize environments and headspaces that might be sort of extractable into creativity and meaning making. So it's, I think it's very common and likely to become a teacher and not have had that trajectory. But that was quite explicitly my trajectory, was I'm going to come into teaching and sort of operationalize what I consider to be the best part of consciousness, right? Creativity, meaning making, thriving, that feeling of flow. I was convinced early that that was good learning, that creativity is sort of the engine of good learning. That's how you build schema. That's how you make sense of the world, is through this sort of playful interaction with the materials of the world and with your passion. Because that was the best thing that I did with my consciousness. As a 20-some-year-old, I saw the movie Dead Poets Society, which I still think is a good movie. But at that time in my life, it was a fucking great movie. And Robin Williams plays this sort of inspiring teacher. And I don't know what year I saw that, but it was way before I was to become a teacher or thinking about it. But it sort of planted a vision of this second self, right? This character who could sort of be that romantic, visionary person that my travel self and my songwriter self and my sort of like, you know, person who reads On the Road and Walt Whitman and, you know, that has this urge towards living large. It's sort of like hippie kind of grandeur, right? Of meeting the world without the restrictions of, oh, I don't know, decorum and bullshit, you know, that you could live authentically and deeply and richly. And Mr. Keating, that's right, that's the name of the character in the movie. And he's got this sort of like romantic flair. And he sort of shows the students who are in this boarding school that the way that they're perceiving the world and that they're expected to perceive the world in this sort of conservative institution has limitations, and that there is another source for beauty and truth. And anyways, that image stuck. And I'm very thankful for that, right? And yeah, to sort of like circle back a bit, like my, when I, because I have some facility in creativity, the idea of being stirred by something like that, when it feels important, and it did feel important as my 19-year-old self saw that movie, respecting myself enough to build with that stirring, I think is the ingredient that has me now lucky to be doing a job that is a union job in an institution. And I, you know, I feel very, in some ways, I feel very outside of the institution. I'm a very uninstitutional person. I don't wear school colors, and I don't get excited about some of the things that you'd think a teacher would be excited about. But I am excited about this idea of offering new lenses, you know, to students, and bringing them through experiences that are, you know, designed to cultivate wisdom and transcendence and joy and sort of seeing the world with novelty and moreness. And, you know, and I have some success, man. I mean, humans are sort of predisposed and designed to flourish, right? Like, we're, kids know this shit, you know, they want, they want to build a world of thriving, you know, they care about authenticity and they care about growing. And so creativity to me is sort of the engine of all that. And so I've sort of built my life as a teacher around creativity and meaning making. So my sort of solution to that dilemma is kind of interesting because, well, in my mind it's interesting because it parses the difference, right? It's like I'm in an institutional setting. My alarm clock goes off at 6:30 in the fucking morning, 5 days a week, which I fucking hate, right? I mean, because I'm a night owl and I would rather be playing rock music and, you know, watching a movie, drinking whiskey at night. But, you know, if I don't get to bed by 11:30, I'm going to be grumpy and yada, yada, yada. So this institutional part of the sort of predicament that I placed myself in, that I have to sort of conform a little bit to the bells, right? And to the structures that the institution offers, gets me up in the fucking morning. And, you know, no matter how, I literally swear every morning the bell alarm goes off. It's a joke between my wife and I, because I will say fuck every time it goes off, probably for 15 years. I don't even know I'm doing it, but I'm doing it. But there's a perspective in that that's, I know myself well enough to know that if I was just like saying, oh, just be creative today, I wouldn't get up at 6:30 and be like heavily engaged in flow consciousness by 9:15, right? I've already worked for an hour and I'm giving her at 9:15. You know, left to my own devices, I would be groggily drinking a coffee and, you know, flipping through my phone at 10 o'clock. if the institution didn't sort of demand my attention. So anyways, it's built in this sort of discipline into my life that is swear-worthy every morning. But in the sort of long-haul version, it has, you know, I'm very thankful for the constraints and demands of this otherwise, like, not terribly, well, I don't want to piss on teaching, but, you know, like, I kind of see it, I've framed teaching as that one of the things in my life that is creative, that is meaningful, that, you know, that teaching itself is an art, and my relationship with students and my building of community, the materials that I bring them through, the conversations I have, are the materials that I care about. And I get to do that every day. And the limitations of the institution have helped me, you know, given me a boundary to sort of do that meaningful work. With dedication and, you know. So, yeah, how do I balance it? I mean, it's almost like it balanced me in some way. Like I'm thankful to my sort of intuitions for seeing an avenue in life that would allow me to sort of manipulate the institutional spaces such that I could define a big enough bubble around my experience to make it meaningful. I'm not sure that, you know, what percentage of that is luck that teaching has allowed me to do it. And I tell you what, I have had moments of great fear when I thought the institution was going to crush me and tell me that I couldn't do the work like this anymore. And I was going to lose my, you know, I teach this film program. I've taught a music program. I've had these neat little niches that I've constructed or that I've sort of bought into and helped to design. But the institution doesn't care about that shit as much as I do. And there have been more than one moment when I thought, oh, God damn it, they're going to steal this special little bubble from me. And then I'm in an existential crisis because because teaching is just like a job scares me, but teaching as a flourishing expression of meaning making and creativity, that gives me a buzz. And so, yeah, I think one of my hopes is in thinking about creativity and like using it as a cultivator of wisdom and a cultivator of flourishing, living a good life, is not in the act of just creating beautiful art or making a great album or painting something beautiful. And those things are worthy and wonderful, obviously. But using creativity as a way of framing the world and framing your relationship to it and practicing the kinds of consciousness, practicing the kinds of attention, practicing making this things salient and, you know, that are copacetic and that are, you know, part of your flourishing so that you look at the world, the institutions, your job or whatever, and you have such an ingrained habit of seeing its potential and like converting it, is that the right word? Sort of bending the expectations of what that is, sort of being a bit of a maverick in culture, stretching the potential of what that cubicle of institutional space offers, such that what you're doing is actually thriving because you've insisted on thriving and you've seen goodness in creativity that that space could use. And that's, you know, so a lot of my career has been spent trying to find that balance, not pissing people off, not, yeah. Sometimes I've actually felt very emasculated and sort of like, I don't know what the word is, yeah, probably emasculated, like where I've had to bite my tongue with, say, principals and powers that be in the institution that don't like me very much, don't get me. I think I have stepped on toes in ways that I sort of bewilder me. I think I'm a nice guy, but I don't know. There's something about being outside, like having your own bubble that other people don't understand, and it's threatening to people in an institutional setting in ways that I've never quite had my finger on that, but I've been hip enough to it to sort of go, oh shit, you know, I gotta dance here because this goddamn bubble is so sacred to me. This this little balance that I found feels very tenuous and feels fragile, and it's terrifying that it could be popped, and it could be popped by a stroke of a pen, by a, you know, by a principal or by someone at the board office. Or, you know, some department head decides that, oh, you're not going to teach it that way, Bowers, you're going to teach it like this, here's the binder. You know, that's like a kick in the gut for me, an existential explosion, you know. So anyways, I'm old enough now, I'm going to make it, goddammit, to retirement. And I will have, you know, something I'm quite proud of. I think I kind of did it, you know. I found a through line in this educational game that has bettered me, you know, like I have utilized the discipline of the institution. I've got a computer lab with, you know, 28 kids in it that are making movies. Like, that's fucking awesome. And it's thriving. And I've, you know, I read a bunch of philosophy and like John Dewey and, you know, like this sort of rich, meaningful parts of my life have come to me because I cared that education was meaningful. So I found meaning in the creation of making meaning. And so, yeah, there's this very interesting balance. And yeah, to be a part of me when I was like a 20-year-old where I would have been like, I want to be a rock star or whatever. And I'd think that I would have been letting my 20-year-old self down by, you know, oh, I got a union job and I'm paying my mortgage and I'm going to retire soon. You know, like that narrative to my 20-year-old self would have been, on the surface, a disappointment. But I have had this epiphany, you know, that actually, if my 20-year-old self didn't just see it from the outside, but, you know, got the inner glance of how their romantic sensibility got to play out in the, you know, intervening 30 years. That, yeah, that my young self would be kind of proud, like, fuck, man, you did it. I mean, he'd rather be, I'm sure my 20-year-old self would rather be, you know, the new Jimi Hendrix or something. But yeah, I suspect that there'd be some pride. And I think that, well, I guess I get to decide that, don't I? There is some pride in the fact that all those romantic yearnings found expression and sort of bloomed in an institutional space. So I hope this made sense. And I have another idea. You can edit the shit out of this if you want. I don't know how long this is going on now, but here's another thing. So I'm a musician, and you know I do play in bands, and I play fairly, you know, frequently. I'm kind of busy on that, so I got this other sort of life. So that is also a big part of happiness and meaning, I guess. Not I guess, I know. But there's this thing that I've realized that I have friends who make a living in music, and that's hard, man. And not that my friends necessarily do this, but there's this idea that there's a built-in compromise required when your art is your life. Maybe there's not a compromise. Maybe if you're good enough, you do whatever the hell you want. Like if you're Paul McCartney, you don't compromise. You just be the Beatles. But like I know people who, you know, would play in a country band that plays, you know, tight, dancey country because those gigs pay, right? And you're playing Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and you get, you know, a decent paycheck for playing in this band, and you're off in Brockville and Belleville playing these country bars. And, you know, it's great. I mean, it's like it's still playing guitar and it's still fun and singing harmonies. But I'm not going to do that gig. Like, I already got a paycheck, so sweet. I'll play original weird frickin' music, right? Like, the commercial part of it is now not important. So there's this, I'm sure it's ironic or paradoxical or something, where it's like, if you don't rely on the paycheck part, then you're given more artistic freedom, and you can spend more time pissing around with your friends in the studio trying out that stuff. So there's a certain way in which creativity, art, is more there's more freedom in it if it's not commercial, and you can do it at your own speed and follow your own muses and not consider the paycheck at the end. That just felt like an amend, you know, something I wanted to add on there, because that has proven true for me. Thanks so much for offering this this excellent question and this sort of I don't know, this answering online kind of thing, this like voice, I think it's kind of fun to chat with myself in this room, knowing that it's going to be heard by someone who cares about making meaning and living a life. That's it. I hope this lands.
So once again, thank you to Peter, Olga, Rainbow, and Kevin. And if you're just joining now and have not listened to the previous episodes of the Meaningful Living series, I would highly recommend that you go back and listen to some of those. In the coming weeks, I will be releasing more conversations that I've had. And as always, I'm looking forward to hearing from you. I hope you're doing well, and until next time. This is Brian Cam, and you've been listening to Clear Story. Since you've listened to the end of this episode, you're exactly the kind of person that I would love to hear from. So please visit briancam.com, where you can find links to my social media and other ways to contact me. If you would like to receive infrequent updates about my work, please subscribe at briancam.substack.com. If you're interested in supporting my work, please visit patreon.com/briancam, where I post everything that I'm working on. Both of those links are in the show notes, and I look forward to hearing from you.